Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to Lottie and David. It's Thursday the 6th of June and you're listening to Game On. Coming up today, Bernard Jackman is in studio to preview a decisive weekend for three Irish provinces in the URC quarterfinals. In soccer, we'll hear from Shamrock Rovers, Head of Education, on how they're helping young players mix soccer and school. In our women's football slot, Rebecca Cray will talk league and cup action, while Jeff Shepherd has our eye on America. And it's tip-off in the NBA finals. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552. We're on X at GameOn2FM, or you can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game on, on 2FM.
Rebecca and Bernard are with me in studio. It's one of my favourite times of the year when countries start to name their squads for major tournaments. The Euros are coming up very shortly and England has been announced. So Jack Grealish, James Maddison and Harry Maguire are all out of the England squad. Harry Maguire has failed in his battle to be fit for the tournament in Germany. Rebecca, there is so much talk about this England squad because it feels like and seems like they just have so many good players.
Yeah, there's too many to mention, you know, like Jude Bellingham in there, you know, you've Trent Alexander-Arnold to name but a few. But yeah, like Jack Grealish, I'm sure I'd be disappointed not to make the final cut. He kind of had a bit of a up and down season with Man City, fell out of a bit of form with Pep, you know, 3 goals across 36 appearances for the club. So it seems to be the case that after, you know, making 2 major tournaments under Gareth Southgate, he's just not made this one.
Maddison wrote on social media about how he felt, saying he's devastated, he trained and he worked hard. But he actually went on and said that he felt that if he was being honest, that his form with Spurs when he came back from injuries in the second half of the season wasn't at the levels that he had set, and gave Gareth Southgate a decision to make. But he said he felt that he still thought there would be space for him in the 26-man squad, as he would bring something different and he'd been a mainstay in the whole qualifying campaign for Euro 2024. And he said the manager has made a decision. I respect that. He went on to say he'll be back and he wished the boys luck. It's so rare to get anybody be so honest about how they're feeling. Usually you just get nothing, but he's actually questioning the manager a little bit, saying he felt he thought that he did enough. He went on to say then, of course, that he will support them. But strange, Bernard, isn't it?
Yeah, I read the message earlier and I was like, it's like someone, he was just venting and then someone said, you better tidy it up there. But he leaves the middle bit in. So look at that. He did, I suppose he did promote Southgate a bit, but there's definitely an element of obviously frustration there, but public frustration. And I don't know whether, look at this from a fan's point of view or a sporting point of view, it's nice to see people being real people and saying probably what they're saying to their family or their friends. But realistically as well, I think Southgate's job is to pick a squad, and I don't think there's any bias there. He's going to the Euros to try and win it, so he's picking the best squad he can pick. But whether he got it right or not, I suppose time will tell.
Yeah, I don't envy him having to pick a starting 11, especially when you look at the forwards with the likes of Bellingham's in there, Cole Palmer, Bukayo Saka, Phil Foden, Ollie Watkins, Ivan Toney, Harry Kane, Jared Bowen. Like, that's a serious squad he has, Rebecca.
Yeah, like it's mind blowing. Even just reading that out, like it'd be some 5-a-side team with a few subs. Do you know,
Trent's
what I mean?
The midfielder, Trent Alexander-Arnold,
supposedly. But yeah, no, look, he's done well. Obviously, with Liverpool, you know, coming in off the defence and sitting in midfield as well. But it'll be interesting to see now how they fare with that team. You'd like to think they'd go on and win something, but it hasn't been their day in previous tournaments.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it anyway. I can't wait. We'll be previewing it next week on the programme and we'll be covering the games every single day that they're on as well. So there'll be so much to look forward to. Do stay tuned to Game On for the whole of the Euros. It's going to be great. Bernard, it is the time of year when the URC quarterfinals are on. They've crept up on us a little bit. There's been a lot of rugby. It's still going on. We have a few more weeks to go, but it is the time now when we're going to narrow things down and start closing. Leinster Ulster is going to be a fascinating one. Ulster have had the upper hand, surprisingly, actually, when you think about it, on Leinster on 2 occasions already this season. But do you think this is what Leinster need, Bernard, to have to go the hard way to try and get a URC title?
Yeah, I do. I think they need to regain confidence. They haven't won a trophy since 2021, which is obviously a drought in when you look at what Leinster have and the amount of internationals they have, and their form for most of the last 3 years. But there is now, I suppose, a concern about their ability to close out finals to get the job done. And I think if they do win this, obviously Ulster at home isn't a given. They're going to have to go away probably to the Bulls, to South Africa on Monday or Tuesday if they win, and then get back for what hopefully will be a Munster Leinster final if it plays out, if form, I suppose, holds all the way through. So you couldn't argue that that wasn't a hardly fought win if they get to do it. So I think that would build confidence, and I think they'd be desperate. They're desperate to lift the trophy, and not to win the URC again would certainly put big pressure on next year. There's pressure already, but it's the minimum that they should be expected, I think, given the resource they have. Last year they rotated a little bit in that semi-final, which allowed Munster, I suppose, get that win. And now there's nothing else concerning them. They've rested their players enough during the year to be able to go full strength for three games. And the pressure's on. I'm actually looking forward to seeing how they respond to it. I mean, they've had 2 weeks. A lot of these players have had 2 weeks since the Toulouse game to, I suppose, feel sorry for themselves. But now you'd be expecting a big reaction on Saturday.
Yeah, and look, they're going to have to move on from the Toulouse defeat. Let's hear from Robbie Henshaw on his thoughts on how difficult or easy it is to move on from a loss like that.
Yeah, no, it takes a while. It kind of hits you in waves a bit. You know, just the disappointment and the what ifs, and you know, if I did something better, we would have won. All that kind of stuff goes through your head. But you know, it was good. We got out in the pitch on Tuesday and Wednesday, and we just got back to playing rugby. And you know, it's great that we're in the URC quarterfinals now, because it just gives us something to chase now, and I suppose forget about the Champions Cup. Which is great, but again, it does linger like anything. It does linger, and it's in the back of your mind. But I think for us now, we're fully focused and fully chasing this URC.
One thing that Leinster rugby have been used to over the last number of years is knockout rugby, and that's exactly what you faced this weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I think Ulster are going well under Richie Murphy. I think last week they really put it up to Munster down in Thomond, and it just shows. I think they're not afraid to go on the road and to attack a game. So I think, yeah, for us, we need to be probably fast, have a good fast start, and be really accurate and physical, and match them physically, because I think they've a good kicking game, they've a good set piece, and they've really good individuals around the breakdown. So I think for us, yeah, we're just going to go out, start quick, and give it our all.
Robbie Henshaw there outlining how Leinster are going to match up to Ulster in the URC quarter final. Do you think there's going to be a bit of a hangover after the Toulouse one, or is this an opportunity, Bernard?
Yeah, it's an opportunity, and obviously they have the home comfort, Steve Eva Stadium. It's a knockout game, and it's an Irish team in front of them, so realistically they should be able to get over it. It's different. Like, it's still going to be very hard to park it. I mean, for some of the players who got to play last week, like Jamie Osborne, Jack Conan, etc., they've now got back and had a game and had a win, and that'll help them. The other players, like Robbie, like Tyke Furlong, etc., who haven't played, Ross Byrne, Gibson Park, you know, they will just want to get back on the field. And like, the reality is the performance against Toulouse, like, that form should win the URC. Realistically, there is a gulf in it, and that's proven by the fact that only two URC teams got to the quarterfinals of the Champions Cup. So if Leinster can hold their form, they should be fine. It's just the worry now is that defeat on the back of obviously two defeats in a row to La Rochelle will somehow be in their mind. You know what I mean? Like, there's people saying, like someone said to me, oh, they're the Buffalo Bills of rugby. I don't think they are, but obviously you got to start winning sometime, you know?
Oh, that's hard, but it's been a long season.
Yeah, it's been a long season, and like World Cup, yeah. And also, to be fair, whatever, Leinster have 12 or 13 in the Irish team, and another bunch will go. They have to go to South Africa after this. You know what I mean? So, and that's hard. Yeah. It's hard to basically make this the most important thing in your life when you have another 7 weeks of rugby ahead of you, you know, if all going well. Yeah. Actually, well, they still have 7 more weeks of rugby. They just might be playing the next 2 weekends if they don't win on Saturday. But it's interesting, Ulster coming here. Ulster beat them twice this season. Not full strength Leinster size, but beat them twice. And ironically, Ulster have had a tough season, but look to be peaking and look to be improving under Richie Murphy. Were certainly very the best performance under Richie Murphy, I think, was last week in defeat against Munster. So they have nothing to lose. They have obviously come in on the back of two wins against Leinster, and yeah, they've got some match winners in their team. Cormac Isichuku is having a phenomenal run. Obviously, Stockdale's back in form.
Their back row seems quite sound.
Yeah, Timoney's been outstanding. I think there's injury doubts around their second rows a little bit, and they need them, one of them to pull through, but they'll come here in a good place.
Yeah, and Richie Murphy's going to know Leinster inside out.
Yeah, like it's set up perfectly, you know. And I can imagine Richie all those years working with Ireland, working with under-20s, watching Leinster and kind of going, well, if I had a team, this is what I do. And he's obviously beat them 2 weeks ago. Or 3 weeks ago, and now he has a chance to come to the Aviva and try and do it again, and it'd be a fairy tale really if Ulster could come from where they've come from, having qualified for Europe, which was their main objective, to potentially being in a semi-final. Would be a huge end of season to them.
Where are you seeing Richie's impact?
They've changed. They're a possession-based team now, so less kicking. More importantly, I just think they were in a rut, and good players were playing badly. They were playing with a lack of energy. It seemed like a lack of confidence, and that's changed now. So he's new voice. He's given them confidence. He's started to pick some of those youngsters regularly, whereas there was a lot of chopping and changing. And luckily for him, he's a good selector, and the fellas he's given game time, like Dave McCann, etc., have actually taken their chance. You know, they've performed and they've got to play again, and that's going to be really important for Ulster. I mean, you know, Richie a couple of weeks ago was asked about recruitment, and he said, look, we're not Man City. You know, we kind of have to find hidden talent somewhere else, cheap talent, and bring through our own. And you know, he signed an out half from the Wellington Hurricane, from the Hurricanes, Aidan Morgan, who's Irish qualified youngster. He may end up being number one from next year. Like if he becomes a starter and a future international, that's a smart piece of business. But also, as I said, it's the likes of Isichuku, Dave McCann, etc., who are now getting a run of games. And getting the likes of Timoney and Stockdale and Rob Herring back playing with confidence and belief and a smile on their face.
We know that for Leinster, success is one thing only, really, and that's the winning the URC, having a trophy at the end of the season. What's success for Ulster at the end of the season?
Well, I think a good performance on Saturday, to be honest. And they don't have to win Saturday. They've already shown that they've turned a corner. They've made sure they're playing Champions Cup rugby next year, which is what Ravenhill deserves. And they, as I said, they look like they have a plan, and a refund. This all isn't down to Dan McFarland. It's just literally they lost their coach and a CEO at the same time. So Richie being signed for 2 years, they all go into this off season now, when it happens, knowing what they're coming back to and having had a taste of the type of rugby he wants to play, the type of environment he wants to create. So I think they're in a hell of a lot better place than they were 6-7 weeks ago.
Richie must be thrilled heading into this game, not under any pressure at all, really.
No, he's not. And there's massive pressure on Leo and Enster. It's insane how big the pressure is. It'd be very hard to stomach from an Enster point of view if they were to lose to Munster in a final. But to lose in a quarterfinal at home to Ulster, you know, would be incredibly difficult to take. And it's going to be fascinating. The jeopardy for Leinster is massive.
So call it.
Oh, Leinster, yeah. Leinster have to win this. Not just this Saturday, they have to win it.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to leave Leinster and Ulster there, and we're going to go on to Munster and the Ospreys. And just Munster's form in general, Bernard, it's been pretty amazing, really, picking up 44 out of 45 points in their last 9 league games. To be able to turn it on like that, you'd really wonder why they weren't like that all the time.
Yeah, they have, and actually that'll be something that the coaches are very aware of and conscious of, is that they have drifted in and out of games. And they have spoke a lot about their bench, and their bench has been absolutely huge since the African tour. But they would like to be a little bit more convincing, and Ulster really put it up to them. I was down in Thomond Park, like it was very tense because the fans could see everything they'd worked so hard for just slipping away. If they had lost, they would have lost out in home advantage. So they rescued at the end, they closed it out. The likes of Conor Murray being able to come off the bench, being able to bring Ollie Yeager, Gavin Coombs, Thomas O'Hearn, etc., proved to be the turning point, because Ulster didn't have players of, mm-hmm. of that quality. Now, they've got some injuries. Thomas O'Hearn is injured. Nankivell is still injured, but Frisch is back this weekend. So Coombs gets a start. Jack O'Donoghue and Alex Kendallin go on the bench, and it's their job now to come on and try and give them impact. But the Ospreys have had a very good season, based on what the other Welsh regions have done. But realistically, this is what you want of your top seed to get the Ospreys. The Ospreys at home, they just snuck in the last day. They're competitive side, but they're in no way near contenders. And Munster, by finishing first, deserve to have the weakest team in the playoffs and have them at home. And they just got to be absolutely ruthless now and go after them from here. Like Robbie Henshaw said, we got to start fast. It's likewise for Munster. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is bonus territory for Ospreys. And to be honest as well, it's worth pointing out, it's easier for Ospreys to get into the top eight because they play in a pool where they play the other Welsh regions twice. Whereas, for example, Connacht have to play Leinster, Munster and Ulster twice, which is obviously harder than playing the Dragons, Cardiff or Scarlets. And those extra points they got from playing weaker opposition definitely had a say in them being there. And yeah, Munster have to fancy themselves to go and do it this week for sure.
What do you think has been the catalyst for this run of form for Munster?
Yeah, I think the senior player, look at earlier on in the year, they had a lot of injuries. They also had a lot of things off the field. I mean, the delay to get Peter Mahoney's contract sorted out, Conor Murray's contract took a while. David Kilcoyne had been told there was no offer for him. He got signed up last week, even though he's injured at the moment. He is a key part of Munster. Zeebo's future is sorted. He's deciding to retire. Frisch is now, it's clear that he's leaving. There was a couple of months there where, there were six weeks where Munster were trying to get him to stay, he wanted to leave, etc. And all these things off the field have started to fall into place. They've signed a very good South African outside back, Abrahams from Lyon, which is another positive. And yeah, the only thing I would say is they're starting to get a few bodies down. So Rory Scanlon got injured, Nankivell is still out, Joey Carberry's after hurting his hand, so he's out for the rest of the season. You think Thomas O'Hearn is out for the rest of the season, and that was part of the reason their form was bad, was because they had an injury crisis. So they still have enough quality, but certainly Graham Rowntree will be very aware that if they lose two or three more, their chance of winning it will decrease massively.
So it's a case of trying to keep everybody fit.
Yeah, fit. And rotating will help. Now, having said that as well, I mean, don't forget when Leinster and the Bulls were in the quarterfinal, and then Leinster were in the semi-final and final, Munster had a week off, as the other teams in the URC did. But you know, so that can help you keep players fit. Now they've got to go. They went very strong on last weekend against Ulster, so they've got to go 4 weeks in a row now, all the way to the if they get to the final, and that may be a little bit of a strain on some of the bodies, and may expose that squad depth a little bit. And that's what cost them against Northampton in the last 16 away from home. They had so many players injured. But as I said, other teams, you could argue, the Bulls, you could argue the Stormers, you definitely argue Leinster have more depth.
And I know that the Ospreys might not pose a challenge of the same calibre that the other quarter finalists might pose, but just even in terms of having that good test against Ulster, you'd imagine that there's going to be no complacency from Munster.
No, in some ways it's a perfect performance leading into a knockout match, because to be honest, it was a game that Munster thought would have had to believe that they were going to win reasonably easily, and they got themselves into awful trouble, didn't panic, and found a way just to close it out at the end. And that's going to be absolutely crucial for them. Like the same thing happened last year, they were in a battle against Glasgow away from home in this quarterfinal, a battle against Leinster, won away a late drop goal, and a battle against the Stormers. So it's no harm to be winning those tight games. You would like as well, when you're superior on paper, which they are against the Ospreys, to just go and pull away and have a real feel-good factor in Thomond Park tomorrow night, because their form at Thomond hasn't been as good as their away form. I believe there's about 20,000 coming, getting in tomorrow night. So they'll want those people to go and come back in big numbers the following week, which is probably going to be against Glasgow if they beat the Stormers.
So will Glasgow beat the Stormers then?
Yeah, I think they will. The Stormers this year have been quite poor, actually. So I think the Stormers, look at that, Stormers have the players to beat anybody, but I fancy Glasgow, and I fancy Munster to beat Glasgow. I think Munster are going to the final. The other side of it's not as easy call.
Okay, so Bulls and Benetton are
the
other quarter.
Bulls will win that. And then I think Leinster will have to go to Bulls. And then I think Leinster will beat the Bulls. I think it'll be Leinster Munster final.
Well, while we're predicting that, if it is a Leinster Munster final, who'll win it?
The travel factor will help, but I just think Leinster can't afford to lose this year. Like, and when you put Leinster's team on paper, like, there's a reason why, and obviously other Munster fans would argue that too many Leinster players are in the Irish team, but I think Farrell is picking the right players for Ireland. Most of them are in Leinster, and if those players play to form, they should be able to win the URC. Particularly, they've no more distractions now.
So are you saying the right players aren't being picked for Leinster?
No, the right players. Sorry, no, I am. I mean, the Munster fan. A lot of Munster fans would say to me, too many Leinster players in the Irish team, that Farrell doesn't pick the Munster players who are equally as good. But I don't agree with that. I think that Leinster players who play for Ireland deserve to be there. But if they don't win trophies, It makes a better argument for the people who are outside of it. If Munster beat Leinster in the final this year, it will give all those Munster players a boost when it comes to playing against South Africa.
Right, so Munster will have their own motivations to win the URC as well. Bernard Ackman, thank you so much for that. And that Munster Ospreys game is on RTÉ2 tomorrow and on the Player. So do tune in for that. We're going to take a very quick break. Do stay with us, though. We have lots of football to come. We'll be speaking to Stephen Gray, Shamrock Rovers Head of Education. And Rebecca Cray will also join us to talk about all the latest action in women's football.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We are going to turn our attention to football now. And just yesterday, I went along to the Shamrock Rovers graduation. They have the only club-run education programme in the country, and some of their transition year students were graduating from that. So they combine football and education, and they also have a fifth and sixth year programme in conjunction with Ashfield College. So I went along and spoke to Stephen Gray all about the programme. Let's hear it.
Game on.
Football.
So, Stephen, just on tonight, it was your graduation, the first club-run education programme in the country. How proud of you are you of everything that Shamrock Rovers and the education programme have achieved?
Look, immensely proud. We started, 3 years ago. This is at the end of, our first cycle. And by that meaning, we had TYs originally that went to fifth year. Now they're in sixth year doing their leaving cert. So absolutely immensely proud, because the club's taken a really, really holistic approach from the CEO all the way down to the academy staff, all the stakeholders pushing in the direction, the parents, Ashfield College, pushing them, these kids to, provide the best platform we can in a holistic approach now, not just trying to produce footballers, produce really, really good students and ultimately good people. So immensely proud when I see them standing up there and present. And to see their habits and behaviours daily, it's really, really good stuff, yeah.
How important is it for football and education to go hand in hand in this country?
I think it's huge. Listen, it was Shane Robinson's idea 3 years ago. He likes to take advantage of me at times because he knows I like structure and strategy. So about 3.5 years ago, he said, I have this idea about getting them out of school and in here more often, and he threw the words transition year program at me, and he said, could you come up with a plan? And I thought about it for about a week, and then we put a plan together. So being able to take kids out of mainstream education, it's a risk, like, let's be honest, because I would never ever put their education in jeopardy, but now with our link with Ashfield, to have them full time in a full-time TY programme or full-time fifth and sixth year programme, where they get really, really good contact hours, between 12 and 15 contact hours a week, and obviously a really, really good education programme through Ashfield, it seems like a really, really good model, and hopefully we can see evidence of that, like I said, with their daily behaviours, and hopefully when we get the Leaving Cert results in the next couple of weeks.
And from a football perspective then, Stephen, we hear a lot about contact hours, and I guess our academies are compared to ones in different countries, particularly in England. How far off are we from the amount of football that kids, the equivalent of the ones in your education programme, get?
We're there. We're right there with our TY programme. They play, they have between 12 and 15 hours a week. We're right on it there with the elite clubs across Europe. You got to be so careful, Marie, when you're developing these kids at 15 years of age, because they're in their growth phase. So it's not only the contact hours, but it's how we train them, whether we push them really, really hard a session. They do gym. Sometimes they do three sessions a day. The next day they might have a light day and do correctives. But that, we still put that down as a contact hour because they're working on their flexibility, their mobility, their recovery. We have a class where you're working on their mindset. That's another contact hours because you're developing them mentally and emotionally, I suppose. So we're right up there in the TY with the elite clubs across Europe. Our fifth and sixth year model, we needed to do a bit of work on it. And we have done that this year. So next year, so starting in September, our fifth and sixth year model will change. And that change will be they're in school every single day in Ashfield, 8:30 till 12:30. They'll do about 20 hours a week education, and then we'll get them a bus from Ashfield over to Roadstone, where we'll manage their contact hours again and get them up to that 12-hour weekly mark, which is really, really important again for a 16 and 17-year-old.
Ultimately, when we look at Irish footballers now and young Irish footballers, and we know because of Brexit that they're being developed here, do you think that we're moving in the right direction in terms of developing our own young talent now here in Ireland?
Look, I can't really speak for the rest of Ireland. That's a really, really challenging one. I don't like to, disrespect what other clubs are doing. All I can discuss basically what we're doing, and I'm so grateful that we get backing from our CEO. We get financial backing through the board. Obviously, I'm a full-time employee of the club. I'm head of education. Joe Addy Beckoff is with me. He's a full-time employee. We have our facilities, we have our gym, we have our indoor hall, we have our pitches, and we've actually fed the players this year, which has cost money. So I can't really, I can't really make a comment on what other clubs are doing, but we feel what we are doing is pretty good. Everything we do is research-based practice, so we look at what other clubs in Europe are doing. We try something, we will measure it, we will review it, we'll audit it. We'll measure it on, with different metrics, and we're always looking to make it better. But again, I would never disrespect anyone what other people are doing in this country, but hopefully, the people that I work for in this football club think that we're doing a pretty good job, and that's most important.
And just in terms then of the ambitions that you'd have for the kids, and the players and the programme, what are they?
I think it's to develop good people now. I really do. Again, I know I've mentioned that CEO is pushing that. There's different metrics to developing footballers. Is it a first team contract? Is it playing for the first team? Is it becoming a first team regular? Is it selling them as a 16, 17 year old like we have last year to a couple of our players? What are the metrics? So we need to produce good people. We have a holistic approach. We have a really good education program. We have different modules like work experience and field trips and Rovers mindset and leadership, and we get guest speakers in. Now we formed a link with early stages with third level education. We've also formed a link with a really, really big brand employer in the community, which has offered a 14-week intern program. So really what we're trying to do is create this cycle. When they reach sixth year, they could become a student in third level education. They could become a footballer by offering a pro contract. They become employee in the community by means of an intern program. And hopefully we can retain them in some context where they might come in as a coach, or they might come in as an intern S&C person or intern physio. So ultimately, all in all, if we produce these really, really good people, can we retain them and keep them as part of, I suppose, the Shamrock Rovers community and continue to look after them and hopefully offer them full-time employment in years to come, whether it be as physio or as a coach or whatever.
But it would be nice if they became full-time footballers as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, listen, of course, I know our CEO threw out a few different stats in relation to where Ireland are in the standings and in European football, and we have to push the barriers. We have to push the boundaries. There's a few clubs here doing it, and we have to ensure that we're doing best practice. There's no other secret club that is off doing something else. There's, you know, a few top clubs or brand names in this country, and we're Shamrock Rovers, and we need to make sure whatever we're doing is best practice, because ultimately, yeah, it would be nice to produce first team players and international footballers and Champions League players, to be honest.
That was Stephen Gray, Head of Education at Shamrock Rovers Football Club. Rebecca Cray of Shelburne Football Club is with us. Rebecca, just listening to Stephen there speaking about the education programme and the benefits and the importance of it. And we've heard so much about academies and the lack of funding and where we rank in terms of the amount of paid staff we have in academies. And this isn't just about one football club who've education. This is a countrywide issue where we need to have all our young footballers in programmes, getting the contact hours, being educated, and at least trying to make up the ground on the big clubs all around the world. Do you get a sense that we're getting there?
Yeah, it's great to hear the ideas and you know, the objectives that Shamrock Rovers have on that piece there. You know, we kind of speak about our own national team at the minute and how we're so far behind, and, you know, so many senses. It's a case that, you know, the academies have never been up to the standards, you know, compared to across the water in England or across Europe and worldwide. But, you know, with these kind of things coming into play and getting kids, you know, involved in education, where they're going into these academies nearly full time and, you know, getting their 4 or 5 hours education throughout the day and going and training then every single day, it's just that kind of professional atmosphere, you know, and something to build them and, you know, build them as people, which is great to hear him say. You know, he's emphasising the fact he wants them to be good people first, and obviously then players and you know, whatever comes after that follows. But it'd be great to get more clubs on board. Obviously it comes from the top down in terms of, you know, the association funding, government, all that kind of stuff. But I think if we're wanting to have good national teams in, you know, 20 years, we need to be putting in the groundwork now to bring the academies on and, you know, have kids in from the age of, you know, 7, 8, full-time education right up until the age of 18, you know, to train in that professional manner to hopefully then, you know, go on and play professionally and maybe keep them here in years to come and then, you know, further afield as well.
Yeah, and of course then the education gives them the plan B, so that when, yeah, if things don't work out from a football perspective, they aren't just discarded because they have their education in their back pocket. But there are some courses like this for girls already in operation, and I think it's a couple of years on now that there is one being run purely for girls and for football, which is just amazing to think that there's a group of girls there playing full time, getting their education and just becoming better players, Rebecca.
Exactly. Yeah, it's great. I think the transition year programme out the FAI have
and Fingal County Council.
Yeah, and Fingal, exactly. Yeah. Megan Smith Lynch actually of Shelburne is leading that as well out there. So
and
look, fantastic.
Holland, I think, is
that's
her,
right.
Yeah.
So it's a great initiative, you know, and it gives that the girls a taste of what may be to come for them if they do want to pursue it. Obviously, I think education is key in this, that, you know, there's so many people that do leave full time education to go and play in certain countries, you know, predominantly it is males, but, you know, to have that backing of education behind you to, you know, God forbid it didn't happen for people, that they have got that in the back pocket, as you said, and, you know, can have careers no matter what, whether it be within the football environment or outside of that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, look, great work has been done by the coaches and stuff. So hopefully it's more of what's to come.
Yeah, because we need industries for girls and boys and men and women in football in this country. So the Republic of Ireland women's team are going to go to Porquicuive, which is brilliant. Okay, I'm saying it's brilliant for the fans' perspective and spreading football around, I'm sure, from the coaches and the managers and Eoin Gleeson. She likes her routine and being in the Aviva and playing there or Tallaght Stadium, wherever it is. It's a whole new ground. It's unfamiliar. But still, it's nice that they're going to have that Euro 2025 qualifier against France on the 16th of July in Super Valley Porquicuive.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Look, I think Denise O'Sullivan's family would be more than happy.
She'll
probably pack that out halfway at least with her gang down there. But look, it's great to change it up a little bit. I think predominantly the games have been in Dublin over the last little while, so it's great for fans that have travelled the length and breadth of the country to come to games. You know, get them out to these games. Hopefully, I'm pretty sure they'll pack it out, you know, for the girls, given that it's not something that happens often. So yeah, really good.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant, and we will have that game live on 2FM as well, so do tune in for that. A lot of firsts going on really with the women's team of late, and like, we're looking for progress in terms of play, but you know, in the broader picture as well, we are making progress when you think about playing in the Aviva and now going to Páirc Uí Chaoimh and just the bigger crowds and all that.
Yeah, I think it's very easy for people to get caught up on results, you know, on the pitch, but there has been massive results off it, you know, since the World Cup qualification. You know, we obviously have the Aviva has opened up for us, and you know, obviously now travelling down to Páirc Uí Chaoimh, it's, I think there was a few games in Turner's Cross back in the day, but yeah, be great to get obviously a bigger crowd in there. And look, as well on the pitch, you know, the results might not have been gone our way in recent times, but look, the performances are coming through, and hopefully we can build on that.
So now that the dust has settled on those two games against Sweden, what are your thoughts, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think, you know, coming out of the first game, you can kind of say that, look, attacking wise in that first half an hour, we looked really, really up for it, really aggressive kind of style, going for it with the two up top, and trying something different, you know. Obviously at times it did leave us wide open for that counter, which obviously, you know, the results show that in 3-0 it might not have been fully reflective of the performance, but so be it. And the second one again, you know, we were a little bit more compact defensively, kind of went back to what we know. Attacking wise, we had a few kind of chances with Willie-Ann Kiernan and Jess Sue, who played fantastically well. They were quite a handful for the Swedish defence. But yeah, look, it's a case of trying to find that balance now and incorporating, you know, how we attacked in the first game and how we defended in the second game to you know, get up to those levels.
What do you think we need to do when it comes to style of play? There's kind of two schools of thought. Do we go with how we played in the first game against Sweden, or should we just be sticking to more to the second game approach?
I did like the first half an hour, 20 minutes. Yeah, it was great to see, but like, I think it takes a little bit more time. You know, we were more used to that second style of play, with the four at the back, a little bit more compact. You know, defensively we were really, really hard to break down. I think if we're going to play that, we do need to take our chances up top. You know, like, we're looking at the likes of Kira Caruso, so holds up the ball really well. Sometimes in midfield, we're just a bit far off, and in terms of getting close to her, that's what she needs, is that someone in behind. I think that's where we missed Denise O'Sullivan, to just get the ball down, you know, retain it. Ball retention was something that let us down in that second game as well, and you know, bring those wingers in. I'd love to see, obviously, as I think I say this every time, but Katie higher on, Megan Campbell come in there on the left side, given that long throw as well, gives us that kind of added dimension and another dynamic to the game. But look, it's a case of just, you know, these performances, I think, were just what they were. You know, Eileen, I think long term was looking at that playoff position, top 2, 3, 4 teams in the world. You know, we were never going to come out and you know, romp home. But I think performance wise, look, we can be happy and take positives from each game, and look, hopefully we can keep building as a group and into the summer.
When you look back on what we've done so far, Rebecca, and I know we're looking at trying to build on things for the playoff, are you seeing an evolution of play under Eileen Gleeson?
I am, to an extent. I think, you know, people can probably mention about how we were so defensive over the course of time, you know, but I can see, even the way we're moving the ball now, there seems to be a little bit more of a flow to it. You can see that we're trying to, you know, unlock those wingers and get them on the ball a little bit more. It's just that out and out goal scorer that we're missing, and that's something that I think sometimes as well we're kind of over reliant on the Katie McCabe's and the Denise O'Sullivan's, that when they're not playing or they're not maybe up to their top game, we're kind of looking and going, what do we do next? So look, I can see what she's trying to do. Is it there yet? I don't think so. It's very hard to tell over these games, I think, as well, because you're coming up against, you know, top sides. And I think, reverting back to what we know in that last game, yeah, it did stand to us. We still lost, which was hard to take, given it was off a set piece, which we usually would pride ourselves on. So, yeah, look, I can and I can't, you know. It's really, really hard to tell against these teams.
I think we just got through the playoff. We're heading off to the Euros. Everyone would be absolutely thrilled because that would be another major tournament. I think even if you look at the number of girls playing football now, that organically there's going to be a higher quality of player because they're getting better coaching, they're getting more contact hours. We have this thing now called equality, which means that we get access to facilities, which is brilliant. And it's just going to be a natural thing that girls are going to be better at football because of what they've been exposed to.
I think so. And I think it's kind of grown since obviously that qualification for a major tournament, and that's going to be crucial going forward. You know, if we can get through this now and get a decent kind of seed for the playoff, and look, if we were to make those Euros next year, it would be amazing, you know. And I think the participation will continue to increase, you know. Coaches will continue to want to get involved with women's football, and look, we may see more female coaches get involved as well. So look, hopefully it's a case of just keep growing the game, and we just need to keep making those major tournaments. That's it.
To bring Game On the road to Switzerland. Well, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Back here at home, we are into round 9 of the women's Premier Division. The big one really is the Dublin Derby, Bowes and Shamrock Rovers, and Bowes just making a big day of it, which is fantastic to see. They're giving ice creams to the first couple of hundred in, and just trying to get as many through the gate as possible to go and see this Dublin Derby between Bowes and Rovers.
Yeah, exactly. Look, it's a case that they're not too far behind each other in the table. Obviously, Rovers haven't had the best starts this year, only on 4 points, with Bowes on 7 just ahead of them. So yeah, look, obviously a great day out there, the great incentive this year with the Pride event on Saturday. But it's a case of on the pitch, you know, can Rovers come true and potentially get a win under the belt? They lost narrowly to Galway in the last game of the league, 1-0. So I think they'll be out to maybe prove a point after this short break and put it up to Ken Kiernan's side.
So what do you think is happening with Shamrock Rovers? Because anytime I talk to anybody out there, they say they're playing good football, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, they're just not getting the results. Is it as simple as that?
I really don't know. I've been kind of trying to put my own finger on it when I'm watching the games, and I like it's just a case that they always have had, I think, since last year, the great individual players. You know, you look at Anya, you look at Steph. I know Steph maybe hasn't been in as much as she would like. Jamie Thompson seems to have fallen out a little bit of favour there as well. You know, so I'm not too sure. Like, it's a case that obviously they're missing a few players, one or two have left as well, relying on a lot of youth within the club or within the squad. It just doesn't seem to be clicking for them, whatever that might be. They don't have just pressure on from the top down as well. But I think if they get that first win under their belt, you know, we might see a little bit turn in their favour.
Galway United still doing what they're doing so consistently. They host Wexford on Saturday at 5 o'clock. How are you expecting that one to go?
Yeah, look, Galway, they've been steamrolling the last few games, you know. They've had a fabulous start. Wexford obviously going down there, they probably would never have thought they'd be mid-table at this stage of the season given their history. They might be going out again, as I said, to prove a point. Galway will be looking to obviously return to great form. It will be a test though, as we know. Like, they're both quite similar, well, from playing against them. I always remember they're both physical, both tough, both want to win. So look, it'd be interesting to see if Wexford can go down there and get a point or two.
Shall we're going to Tralee United?
Yes, making the trip down to Limerick. Limerick or Treaty have been doing really well this year as well, obviously mid-table as well on 8 points. Will be a test for Shells, no doubt. Obviously second at the minute on 18 behind Galway. Galway obviously with that game in hand. So look, they'd be looking to hopefully travel down there and gather a few points, but Treaty would be a tough outfit.
Cork City going well as well?
Yeah, most definitely. Look, last season, I think at this stage they were bottom. You know, and you can see them now ahead of Rovers, Wexford, Bowes. You know, they'd be rubbing their hands together.
What is it? How did they turn it around so much?
I think it's just a case of trusting the process with Danny Murphy down there. You know, he put a lot of faith in the youth that were coming through. Eva Mangan has done well with them down there. Obviously, she's gotten to the most recent Ireland squads as well. Yeah, so look, it's just a case that they've just kept their heads down, I suppose, and dug deep this year and got some nice results. So look, you know, all fair dues to them. They're only 4 points off peas at the minute, so it's wide open, as we say.
A difficult it's been difficult for DL Orwaves and Sligo, and they face off as well on Saturday.
Yeah, two kind of obviously teams at the bottom there on 3 points. You know, will be pretty similar in terms of you know the game itself. Sligo obviously travelling across to Dublin for that. Be interesting to see how they fare. I know they've had a few injuries on both sides. So yeah, look, it'll be pretty evenly matched, no doubt.
And there was a cup draw today.
There was indeed. There was. Yeah. We're looking at it there. So the first round draw for the FAI Cup, DLR versus Whitehall Rangers, Galway versus Shells. Shells heading away to Galway again. Treaty against Ferns United from Wexford. Bowes versus Piemont, which will be a tasty encounter, no doubt. Cork versus Douglas Hall, and they're all Cork event. Rovers versus Wexford and Sligo versus Terenure.
Yeah, the cup draws have been interesting. The men's one was today as well, and this one was for the second round draw, and some absolutely huge names drawn out against each other. So there's going to be a Dublin derby between Bowes and Shamrock Rovers, which is amazing for the second round. And then St. Pat's were the last team out of the hat, and they are away to Derry. So some really, really big games there.
Drogheda at Dundalk as well.
Yeah, another one there as well. Loads of
derbies.
Yeah, Bray Wanderers, Shelburne, Cove Rambers, Kerry FC. Lots of really good games. They're going to be played on the week ending the 21st of July. So lots to look forward to. We're going to take a very quick break. It is time then for our US sports with Jeff Shepherd. Loads of basketball news, so stay with us.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to US sports, and I'm delighted to say that Jeff Shepherd joins us on the line. How are you, Shep?
I'm doing great, Marie. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. Looking forward to the game one of the NBA Finals. So we have the Boston Celtics and the Dallas Mavericks, and that's getting underway this evening. I'm going to talk about that in just a second, but I do want to talk to you first about what's happening in the women's NBA and the drama between Carter and Clark and that foul, and how it seems to have taken over all of the news outlets there.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not even talking about politics in the election anymore over here. It's nothing but Caitlin Clark. That's all it is. And you know, women's tackle football in the WNBA. So, yeah, just a quick recap. A player on Chicago's team, Chinedu Carter, basically body checked Caitlin Clark over the weekend, hit her from behind on an inbounds pass and knocked her down. And at the time, it was just ruled just a regular foul. And the WNBA reviewed it and made it a flagrant foul. But it's kind of really ignited the discussion about, you know, physical play in the WNBA, and specifically is Caitlin Clark being targeted. And it's not just, oh, is it a rookie that's being targeted? I mean, look, there's discussions about, you know, race and other things that are involved in a, you know, mostly African-American female league. And, you know, you have a younger, you know, rookie and player who's white, and just, you know, people are paying attention. More people are paying attention. You know, Marie, you and I have spoken about this basically every week for the last 3 months, you know? So, I mean, which talks about the popularity that Caitlin Clark, you know, has brought to the WNBA. And it's this double-edged, you know, kind of fine line that these players have to walk. It's like, look, she's bringing exposure to the league. But at the end of the day, you know, they're there to win basketball games. And, you know, if they feel like they can intimidate a younger player until she kind of feels her way through the league, then they're going to do that. Now, there are some discussions about, you know, the extent to the physicalness of some of these fouls. And, you know, one of the other things too, Marie, is why aren't her teammates stepping up for her? You know, when are one of them going to throw an elbow at somebody to kind of send a message as well? So it's just a lot. It's been swirling all over, you know, media. And you know, this is one of those stories we talk a lot about, Marie. When you move off the sports pages into, you know, the main political discourse and the front page of the newspapers, you know, you're making an impact, and it's a big story. And that's where we've been, I'd say, for the last 4 or 5 days, you know, with regards to Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, big news. Also big news, though, is the NBA Finals Game 1. How is this going to play out?
So, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago with Pat Burke about, you know, the Celtics and the Mavericks, how they were both probably kind of heading towards the finals. And that's exactly where we ended up. The Celtics swept the Pacers, and the Mavericks beat the Minnesota Timberwolves in 5 games. And so now they're set to finally get started. Look, the Celtics have been the favorite all season. The Mavericks, you know, they've been hot lately, really kind of since the trade deadline. But, you know, the Celtics had no problems in Eastern Conference Finals. I thought it was really interesting, Marie, though. The Celtics are only the third Eastern Conference team in the last 24 years to be favored to win the finals. So that's got to be some LeBron teams, you know, in Miami or LeBron in Cleveland. I mean, that's the only time that could have been the case. Interestingly enough, though, 80% of the bets this week were made on the Mavericks. So I don't know if folks are just hedging their bets or, you know, maybe they're feeling like the Mavericks are getting hot. You've got the Kyrie Irving element to it. You know, he never leaves a place, you know, calmly. He played in Boston and then left and, you know, kind of lit the match on the way out when he was walking out the door. So, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot. The Celtics fans are going to be fired up to have him, you know, in the finals. If you ask me, Marie, if you've got a team who's been the favorite all season, they clearly have been the best team in the Eastern Conference. They had no problems whatsoever in the finals. I mean, I'm not saying they come out and sweep, but I think the Celtics, you know, need to be the favorites and are the favorites, you know, to win this series. They're looking for their 18th championship. That would be the most in the NBA.
Sounds like it probably will go that way, but there's a lot of basketball to be played for the next little while. Shep, as always, thank you so much. Looking forward to talking about this again next week. Rebecca Cray, thank you very much as well for coming in to studio. That is it from us this evening. I'll be back tomorrow looking ahead to all of the weekend's sport action. January Winters is up next.
RTE 2FM.